Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Earlier today, we heard a lot about presidential power in the 18th century and some discussion about whether that conception remains appropriate or relevant to the contemporary era. And so this panel is entitled Rethinking Presidential Power in the 21st Century, and the panelists are eminently qualified through their research and also their experience in government in speaking to this topic. So I'm delighted that we have this panel. I'm also delighted that Professor Farber of the School of Law is here to chair and moderate the to moderate this panel. And Dan, why don't I just turn it right over to you? Okay.
Thank you. I just about an hour ago got back from Galesburg, Illinois, where they are celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. So I was able to stand on the steps. Historians have a lot of disagreements. Everyone seemed to agree, however, that the debates have gone downhill since 1858, and that it was very unlikely that the upcoming debates would be in the same category. With that said, let me turn it over to Phil.
I want to begin with the eight words I most hate hearing from a speaker. And they are, I've got to put aside my prepared remarks. I've always had terrible experiences with talks that begin that way. But having attended part of the meeting this morning and reflecting on the subject that Dan asked us to speak about, I think that's what I should do, and then perhaps if I have time, I may include just a little bit of what I was going to say. What I had prepared was a rather bone-chilling hypothetical of the kind that John Mueller's always ridiculing, and I hope I have some time for that. But instead, I'm going to take up something else, and that is whether or not we're at war. Because it seems to me that if you're going to discuss the presidency, the modern presidency, and its role in war, it might be useful to ask yourself, are we at war now? My guess is, if I took a poll of the audience here, certainly a poll of my friends in academia, it'd be very hard to find anybody who thought that the idea of a war on terror really made any sense. We think of as terror as an emotion, terrorism as a technique, not limited to the pursuit of any particular ideology. It's hard to see how you'd have victory in a war on terror. Who would sign the treaty? The disruption. Yes, sir.
You might think of it as a war of terror, more exactly.
Well, you might think of it that way now, but after you've heard my speech, maybe you'll change your mind. The notion that you can be at war and yet have civil society continue as it is with so little disruption seems to count against there being a war on terror. By contrast, just to give you a metric, during World War II, on average, 16,000 people died every single day of the conflict. But if a war on terror, just as an idea, sounds like a sort of overblown metaphor, I would urge you to think again. Let me just sketch out something for you, focusing on three terms, on terrorism, on warfare, and on victory. Most people who say they know terrorism are talking about the IRA or the PKK, the PLO, the FLN, ETA. They know 20th century nation-state terrorism, the terrorism used by national liberation groups to get a share of the pie or to secede from a stronger regime. They do not think about the Catholic mercenaries who sacked Antwerp in 1576. Antwerp was the leading financial center of Europe. It never recovered from these outrages. They don't think about the Lutheran mercenaries who sacked Rome in 1527. Erasmus wrote to Sadoleto, not just a city, but a whole world has been destroyed. They don't think about the Pirates of the Caribbean. You may think of them as movie stars, but they were the terrorists of that period of the 17th century. They had pirate kingdoms. They had written constitutions. They set up judges and courts. They sacked Panama, killed almost every living thing there. They don't think about the terrorists in America, the Iroquois and the Algonquin, who mutilated colonists, terrorists used by the great powers against colonists. They don't even think about the anarchists of the 19th century, anarchists who killed an American president, a Spanish king, a French president, killed the Tsar. They killed, of course, the Archduke and Archduchess at Sarajevo. They just think about 20th century terrorism. But the state that gives birth to a certain kind of terror changes. It's changed before. And I think it's changing again. I think our own state is becoming more decentralized, more devolved, becoming more networked, more global, outsourcing and privatizing more of its activities. And the same thing is even truer of the European Union. A state like that, what I've called a market state, will produce a terrorism that is global, networked, that outsources and privatizes its operations, that is decentralized and is devolved. And our relation to it will be very different from the relationships we've had with the terrorism we thought we knew in the 20th century. Terrorism is becoming more warlike. For five centuries, since the birth of the modern state at the time of the Renaissance, only a state could pose lethal threats to another state. Only states could keep armies in the field, sometimes for decades at a time, master complex logistics, conduct complex alliance diplomacy, produce new and ever more lethal military technologies. That's still true, but it won't be true for long. In the hypothetical I was going to read you, I had terrorists set off an atomic demolition mine. Actually, I think biological weapons are probably much more likely to be the terrifying thing deployed by terrorists in the 21st century. But the fact that the terrorist of the 21st century kind, not the terrorist of the 20th century variety, will seek weapons of mass destruction and will use them and will find himself able to get them as these weapons become cheaper and more ubiquitous is something that will make terror more warlike. At the same time, warfare is becoming more like terror. When General Tommy Franks announced the end of major combat operations, 146 men had died of the coalition's forces. Now, all of you know since then, more than 4,000 more have died. Was General Franks lying to us? No, he wasn't lying. He had in mind a certain picture of warfare, just as we have a certain picture of terrorist. He thought, I've occupied the enemy territory. The enemy army has surrendered. I've removed the political leadership. I've captured the capital. It's over, right? But, of course, it wasn't over. Instead, a whole new pattern of warfare began to emerge. And it is that pattern, I think, that will dominate at least the first few decades of this century. Finally, we have a picture of victory. All of you have probably the same picture. Pretty girls kissed, sailors' caps thrown in the air, bunting everywhere. On VE Day, the crowds in Whitehall were so thick that Churchill's car was lifted off the surface and pushed all along down to the House of Commons. We had similar scenes at the time of Waterloo. But victory has not always been quite so easily characterized. Some of you may think that victory is the defeat of the enemy. That's not right. That's football. That's chess. It's not warfare. Victory in warfare is the achievement of the war aim. You can kill a lot of the enemy and still lose a war, and you can even lose many battles and still achieve your war aim. My students think that we won the War of 1812. And in a way we did, because we achieved our war aim. But I tell them, if your capital is burnt and your major city is occupied, you're not winning. If you reevaluate these terms, the achievement of the war aim, which changes from era to era, terrorism, which changes as the nature of the state changes, and warfare, which is changing before our very eyes, then I think it is not so foolish to think of a war on terror, because it's not terrorists we fight. Terrorists do not destroy the stability of a society as rich, as stable, and as strong as ours. It's terror. And the way terror grips us is when we refuse to prepare for it. Now, I have a different set of guesses than some of my friends about how likely it is that we'll experience some catastrophic event in the next couple of decades. But whether I'm right or wrong about that, I feel very confident that we are not thinking about it, that we are not preparing for it, so that if it does happen, we know what to do. I'll give you just one example if I have time, Dan. If the fourth plane on September the 11th had hit its target, it would have hit the Capitol. They weren't going for the White House. They were going for the U.S. Capitol. And if it had hit in time, the time it was allotted to, it would have struck during a roll call vote in the House. It's not fanciful to think that if you dumped all of that jet fuel into a closed chamber, you would have burned and killed a great many people, quite possibly disabling more than half of the House. Now, we know, all of you know anyway, that the House is not reconstituted like the Senate. It's not reconstituted by appointment, but rather by election. And that means at a minimum something like 180 days. What would you do in the meantime? How would you pass laws? Well, the president would probably rule, probably by some kind of martial law. Where's the power for that in the Constitution? Why don't we adopt an amendment now to foresee this and put that amendment on the shelf the way we put vaccines on the shelf? What if the members of the Supreme Court were killed and we couldn't quickly confirm new members because there was some disagreement between the president and the members of the Senate? We have 13 chief judges of 13 circuits. You could, by statute, easily provide for an emergency court in the case that six, seven of the members then sitting were killed or disabled. But we don't do these things. We should be stockpiling laws the way we stockpile vaccines, because it is terror, not terrorists, that is our greatest concern. Thank you.
Following Philip Bobbitt, I, for one, am not going to put my comments aside. I'm going to cling to them all the more tightly. We were asked to reflect a little bit about how it is that Congress and the President take us to war and how past practice might dictate future practice. These are big questions. And as it happens, actually, at least one answer has been put before us. And it's that answer that I want to turn my attention to for my comments today. This past summer, former Secretaries of State James Baker and Warren Christopher issued the National War Powers Commission report, which sought to restore some sense of balance between the branches of government during the lead-up to war. And what I'd like to do with my time is to briefly summarize the report's claims and then to offer what I believe are some of its more egregious deficiencies. And I'm going to do this not because I'm interested particularly in throwing dirt on a well-meaning report, but rather to underscore what I think is a really important factor in understanding how we go to war, namely domestic politics, and a factor that lawyers and public administration scholars all too often, I think, ignore when they seek remedies for perceived failures of governance. So from the outset, let me just state my bottom line, which is any effort to check presidential war powers that doesn't think seriously about the underlying incentives and motivations of presidents and members of Congress and judges to behave in an existing a system of governance, not one that we might prefer, but an existing system of governance, will have little practical impact on how we as a nation go to war. Politics does not now, nor has it ever stopped at the water's edge. So the report, the National War Powers Commission report, it's the culmination of a massive effort to reform relations between Congress and the President during the lead-up to war. And it's the result of years of study and consultation with some of the people in this room, and includes in its membership former secretaries of state, current and former senators, university presidents, deans, high-ranking military officials. This is a major undertaking. And the Commission's core objective was to develop and defend a replacement for what it calls an impractical and ineffective war powers resolution. It's impractical, the war powers resolution, that is, the Commission argues, because presidents openly flout it. Congress refuses to stand by it, and the judiciary can't even gather itself to affirm its constitutionality. And it's ineffective, the Commission suggests, because certain elements of the War Powers Act are certainly unconstitutional, and it doesn't do enough to encourage what it calls dialogue and cooperation between the branches. So in its place, the Commission recommends the War Powers Consultation Act, which they hope will be enacted into law in 2009. And this legislative proposal requires the President to consult with members before launching significant military ventures, that the President and a newly formed Joint Congressional Consultation Committee consult with one another regularly thereafter, and that Congress vote on an authorization either to support or to oppose a military initiative within 30 days. And there are a number of levels in which we might engage these set of recommendations, whether or not they conform to different understandings of the founders' conceptions of the proper division of war powers between Congress and the President, whether or not we might actually expect the next president and the next Congress to enact this into law, and whether or not what we really need is more consultation, whether or not that's a good thing. I'm going to put these matters aside, and I have little to say about them. And instead, I want to take the report on its own terms and reflect upon whether the War Powers Consultation Act can be expected to alter, in any meaningful sense, the interbranch dynamics that precede military deployments. Because it is, after all, on this point that the report prides itself. The report repeatedly notes the Commission's intentions to offer what it calls a pragmatic approach for how Congress and the President can work out their differences during the lead-up to war. And I want to make two points. First, alone, legislative enactments, which Madison disparagingly referred to as parchment barriers to executive authority, legislative enactments alone will not serve as a meaningful check on presidents who have profound incentives to consolidate and expand their power generally and their war powers in particular. Point number one. Point number two is Congress as an institution cannot be counted on to ensure that future presidents act in ways that are consistent with the War Powers Consultation Act. So let me take them in turn. Even if the War Powers Consultation Act is enacted, can we expect presidents to abide its central provisions? I suspect not. And to see why not, it's worth thinking a little bit about the core motivations of presidents, at least in the last 75 years, during which time an avalanche of expectations and aspirations, public expectations and aspirations, have fallen at the doorstep of the White House. If members of Congress are best thought of as single-minded seekers of re-election, as David Mayhew suggested some 35 years ago, it seems to me presidents might be thought of as being single-minded seekers of power. Individual presidents may have ulterior motives, to be sure. They may have concerns about enacting good public policy, building upon or undoing the actions of their predecessors, securing their place in history, acting on a perceived public mandate. But to accomplish any of these things, presidents need power, and so it is power that they seek and power that they guard. And while different presidents from different parties may advance different policy agendas, all in one way or another, will seize upon opportunities to fortify their influence. They'll resist efforts of adjoining branches of government to encroach upon their influence, and they'll exploit any ambiguities that the Constitution may have about what their base of authority is for their own purposes. And so presidents will, I want to suggest, with the War Powers Consultation Act, which offers a host of ambiguities of its own. Take, for instance, the requirement that the president consult with Congress in cases of significant armed conflict. So what makes an armed conflict significant? At what point do we say it is significant? And how do we even know that every single military deployment constitutes an armed conflict. Answers to these questions, when pressed, right, are less than straightforward. So recall, Truman calls Korea police action. In the 60s, first Kennedy and then Johnson insisted that they were deploying U.S. troops merely to train and advise Vietnamese forces. According to Reagan, Lebanon was a rescue and peacekeeping operation, and Grenada was a mere rescue mission. In each of these cases, presidents redefined their actions in ways that allowed them, at least in the public's eye, to avoid the very kinds of consultations that Baker and Christopher are hoping to foster. And the commission is not right blind to these realities. When making their case against the War Powers Resolution, they point out, quote, "Presidents have regularly involved the country's armed forces in what are clearly hostilities under the terms of the statute, while claiming the statute is unconstitutional or not triggered in this particular in a particular case," end quote. The commission, though, gives us little reason to believe that under the new statutory frameworks that presidents will behave especially differently. And the reason is they don't, in any profound sense, alter the core motivations that presidents have, again, namely to expand and guard their power. The ambiguities don't stop here, though, in the statute. What, after all, constitutes sufficient, quote, consultation? What exactly does that mean? Right? And what are presidents to do if members of Congress demand either too much or too little information during the lead-up to a military deployment? Presidents, even when pressed by co-partisans in Congress, have powerful incentives to resist sharing intelligence, strategy, or other information that they consider sensitive. And for their part, members of Congress have incentives to occasionally skirt their own constitutional or statutory war obligations. As the lead-up to the Iraq War demonstrates, in my mind at least, Congress did not lack the legal tools to consult with or engage a Republican president. Rather, it lacked the political incentives to do so. And this brings me to my second point, which is that Congress is unlikely to defend the central provisions of the War Powers Consultation Act. So for starters, I think it bears mentioning that the Act does not provide much new to Congress that it doesn't already have, right? It already can constitutionally, has the power to express its views about a war, either in support or in opposition, to demand that the president provide information about a prospective or an ongoing military deployment, and to pass bills to authorize, end, or otherwise govern a war. And the fact is, Congress regularly chooses not to exercise these powers. A variety of contributing factors explain why. I want to emphasize the role of party politics, which was front and center in our conversation in the first panel, but was alluded to as well in the second, when we think about, again, the underlying incentives of political actors to check one another's power. Congress does, to see this right, Congress does not act as an institution to fulfill its basic constitutional obligations. Rather, members of Congress act as individuals or as coalitions in an effort to advance their policy objectives, to fortify their positions within Congress, and to maximize their chances of re-election. And the probability that these members will challenge the presidential use of force, demanding presidents to share information and adjust their military planning, critically depends upon the alignment and the affiliation of their partisan affiliations. Democrats within Congress regularly and predictably are going to back Democratic presidents. Republicans are going to do the same with Republican presidents. And when there are interbranch contestations with regards to the use of force, most typically we observe them across party lines when there are divisions across the parties. And so recall that Republican members in Congress almost uniformly lined up in 2002 behind the war in Iraq. Democrats were split about evenly. If you look at those Democrats within Congress who supported the military use of force, one of the best predictors of who were the Democrats that backed the president, they were Democrats who came from either districts or states where Bush had done particularly well in the 2000 election. And so persistently and unavoidably, party politics and electoral incentives inform Congress's willingness to challenge the presidential use of force, to stand by, in this case, the essential dictates of the War Powers Consultation Act. And these party politics, I'd like to suggest, also have larger implications for the actual exercise of military force. So I have a book that just came out called While Dangers Gather that tracks the willingness of presidents to exercise military force over time, the frequency with which they do so, and the timing, how much time passes between an emergence of a problem abroad and when there actually is a U.S. deployment or response. And one of the best predictors of it has to do with the partisan alignment of Congress and the president. This shouldn't come as a great surprise in some ways, right? Because co-partisans within Congress are unlikely to force a president to consult with them more regularly than they already do. And members of the opposition party, meanwhile, may well challenge the president, but they'll do so not out of a sense of obligation to fulfill the basic dictates of, in this case, the War Powers Consultation Act, but because they have, again, political incentives to do so, to challenge an opposing party and to who's leading us to war, and to underscore mistakes that he, someday she, has made in the ongoing course of a war. So let me wrap up. The Commission posits that the War Powers Consultation Act constitutes what it calls a practical replacement of an improvement on the War Powers Resolution, which is, you might argue, the existing statutory framework that's supposed to guide how we go to war. The basis for this claim lies in its appeal to common sense, its transparency, and the purported benefits of increased dialogue across the branches of government. But I'd like to submit that when we think about whether or not a proposal is politically is practical, it critically depends upon whether or not it conforms to the underlying incentives of those political actors who are actually going to be operating underneath within the existing framework, and whether or not there exist political actors to stand up for this framework when other political actors, namely the president, act outside of it, disobey its central provisions. And by ignoring the domestic politics of war, I argue the War Powers Consultation Act is really not practical at all. We can't expect it to meaningfully change how we go to war. Presciently, the founders anticipated that the practical division of war powers would not be negotiated once and for all. Rather, it would be subject to continual contestation between the branches of government. Again, that contestation, for the most part, certainly in the modern era, is defined by partisan divisions. And there seems to me there's little reason to believe that no one particular statute, not the War Powers Resolution, nor the proposed War Powers Consultation Act, is going to settle once and for all that contestation. Thank you.
Let me begin by saying something which is at least obvious to me, and you can decide whether it's obvious to you. And that is a contrast between the discussion we've had so far this afternoon and the second panel this morning. I would say the weight of opinion of the second panel this morning was that, you know, if we look at the recent history, the president has exceeded his authority, has violated the Constitution, and the reaction, I think, from most of you in the audience was that was a bad thing. I think at least if we look at the two speakers that have gone so far, and myself as well, I can't speak for Steve Skronik, one of our very distinguished presidential scholars. You know, the view is, who are you kidding? You know, the Bush is no exception to what's happened if we look at the history of the last 50 years. If you look at the period, this is some data on the use of military force by the United States for the period 1950 to 1999. This includes all kinds of things, everything from wars like Vietnam, things that would usually be called wars, to the Iran hostage rescue, abortive Iran hostage rescue, to Kosovo. There were 33 cases in this period, 1950 to 99, in which the United States used force. There was no authorization in 21 out of the 33 cases, and in only 8 of those 33 cases was there pre-authorization, something that might actually conform with what, I mean, I think my colleague Jack Rakoff and Louis Fisher said this morning, is the way the system ought to work. Under Clinton, there were 13 instances in which Clinton used American forces abroad. In 11 of those cases, there was no authorization at all. In 2 cases, there was pre-authorization. So one thing that's clear is if we look at the post-war period, we're certainly not operating under an interpretation of the Constitution which says, gee, if the president wants to use American forces abroad, he ought to get some kind of authorization from Congress. Granted, not all of these are actually examples of what one might call war. Right, why is this? So I want to go over in a few minutes what I think are some of the basic structural conditions of the contemporary international environment, although I admit in talking about terrorism, I'm neither as informed or as elegant as Phil Bobbitt. right, there are some elements of the contemporary international environment. I should say I'm an international relations scholar. I'm not a student of American domestic politics or a lawyer. There are some elements of the contemporary international environment which are very familiar, the rise of China and India, as one example. I mean, we've looked historically, I mean, what we see are historical periods in which the countries that have the major amount of power in the international system changes over time. You have the rise of Germany in the 19th century and the early 20th century, the rise of the United States in most of the 20th century, the dominance of the United States since the end of the Cold War. We have one condition which is very, well, not unusual, is unique, which is this, what political scientists have called a security community among the major Western powers. That is, I think it's fair to say that at least for the foreseeable future, it's very hard to see that you would have a war that would involve Europe, the United States, Japan, or even the OECD countries in general, Mexico, Korea. And that is something that one could never have said before historically. So we're now, since 1945, in the longest period at any point over the last 500 years in which there has not been a war among the major powers. And that's something that is certainly something that is a change from everything that existed before. All right, there are, however, I think, it's not clear to me that either of those structural conditions, that is either the rise of China or the rise of China and India, or the fact that we have a security community among major Western powers, tells us much about why we've had this pattern in which there's been very limited presidential engagement with Congress if we're looking at the use of force by the United States. So let me focus on some other things which are also different and changed. And the first is, and it's something that people alluded to this morning, U.S. hegemony. Also historically unique. It's not just that the United States does spend either more than the next 20 countries or 25 countries or everybody else combined in the world, depending on what measures you would use. But a figure that I find kind of factoid, not a figure that I find striking, is that one U.S. aircraft carrier could strike 700 targets in one day, which is more than any other air force in the world, and we have 12 carriers, and that doesn't count the other stuff we have. If you look at the American economy, it's 27% of world GDP. If you look at technology, 51% of patents in 2007 were issued to American patent holders by the U.S. Patent Office, and that's down, I mean, it's going down, obviously, but it's going down pretty slowly. If you look at culture, various kinds of soft power, you know, the 100 grossing films, to the extent that I know they were Hollywood films, are all American films. This is an historically unprecedented development, not something that we've ever seen before. Second phenomena of the contemporary international system, which is new and I think bears on this question of presidential authority and presidential use of force, is the presence of the international environment of a substantial number of failed and weak states. By various measures, something between 37 and 73 states in the international environment are failed states. This does some things which are discomforting. It generates transnational crime. I'm sure we've all gotten the emails from Nigeria, which, by the way, actually work. You can make money doing it. That's why they keep doing it. Transnational disease, I mean, these are things we've seen in the past. Certainly disease is not something new. But the big kick here is obviously transnational terrorism. Obviously this is something that has multiple causes. And we have no consensus now actually on what the primary causes are or which of these causes is most important or whether they're all equally important or whether some of them are irrelevant. So Islamic radical ideology, the failure of the Islamic world to meet the challenge of modernization, political repression in the Arab world, something that the administration certainly focused on, the alienation of Muslim immigrants in Europe, failed states which can offer sanctuary and safety, Afghanistan, obviously now the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Regardless of what you think these causes are, and here I'm just going to restate what Phil Bobbitt said, they pose an unknown and unknowable threat. Some really bad things could happen. We don't have a good way of assigning a probability estimate to them. You know, is your expected utility of dying from a terrorist attack some fraction of 1%, you know, 1%, 5%, 10%? It's something that we have no way of reliably estimating. But what it is fair to say is that if this actually happened, it would be a very bad and very damaging thing, which would not only change the way we think about it, that is, if we have a set of major terrorist attacks in the United States and elsewhere, it would not only change, I think, our attitudes about civil liberties in the United States. We may feel kind of annoyed about these lines at airports. And people may feel discomforted. My guess is most people in this room about the Patriot Act. I mean, I'm willing to bet if you had two terrorist attacks in the United States which killed several thousand people, and these attacks could kill many more, the American population would be screaming for a level of constraints which we've never seen in this country. I state that as a fact. You can decide whether you think it's true. So we're in a situation now in which, as Professor Bobbitt alluded, suggested, in which, and this is something which is, we haven't had before, in which very, very weak actors in the international environment, some of which may be very weak states like North Korea, some of which may be transnational terrorist organizations, can do really wreak havoc on major powers in the world. The GDP of North Korea is something like less than 0.2% that of the United States, less than 0.5% that of Japan, about 1.5% that of China. It's clear the North Koreans could kill hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people in Japan, Russia, and China. It's as if in 1914, in July of 1914, the Germans were worried about a damaging attack from Liechtenstein. This is not a situation that we have been presented with at any point in the past. And if an attack from either one of these very weak states or transnational terrorist organizations did take place, I mean, I think it's not only that you'd throw out domestic rules of the game, but I think you'd also throw out a lot of international rules of the game. Major terrorist attack, which we trace back to the tribal areas in Pakistan, this debate that we've been having about whether or not we should intervene in the tribal areas would be out the window. And again, as would be the case if this happened in terms of its domestic consequences, the international consequences would be extremely discomforting. So I'll say forcefully, and I'll try and defend this if you want to ask me questions. I think some of the kind of misgivings that a number of the panelists had this morning about presidential authority may sound like something we ought to give real consideration with. Certainly a number of people are very discomforted by the current administration's policies. But I think the combination of American power and the unprecedented and unknowable nature of the threat that we confront now inevitably drives us to a situation in which the assertions of presidential authority that we've seen not only in the Bush administration, but in earlier periods, is with us now and will stay with us and is not going away.
I think it's actually fitting that my veto was left off of the introductions because I'm an odd fit on this panel talking about the 21st century since most of my work is historical and talking about war making, about which I've written very little. But I want to speak to one of the questions that was posed to us, and that is about does the post-9/11 world mandate a change in our thinking about the proper scope of presidential power? And to do so actually by, again, returning to that second panel and to some of Gordon Silverstein's points, which I will echo in a slightly different way. Because it seems to me that at issue is not just the novelty of the external threats now facing the United States, but how the debate about the proper scope of presidential power has come to be framed in recent decades and seems likely to be framed going forward. As I listen to debates about presidential power surrounding the Bush administration in general and the Iraq War in particular, what I hear is essentially a constitutional debate. And here I'm invoking that great example, that terrific panel of this morning. If I were to characterize that line of thinking, which certainly goes well beyond the panel, I mean, I think this is the dominant way we're thinking about the problem, I would describe it as post-progressive. Post-progressive in that it rejects the pragmatic, experimental, and largely extra-constitutional argumentation that was employed by the long line of reformers who actually helped build the modern presidency over the first two-thirds of the 20th century, and who in the process transformed the operations of modern American government. What I hear from both critics and advocates of presidential power today is part of a larger intellectual reaction against progressive reasoning, a reaction that began in the 1970s and whose leading features are an abrupt return to legalism, formalism, and constitutional theory. I've been struck by this because I'm just recently embarked on a project actually sparked by the debates over the unitary theory and all that, about what these progressives were thinking when they advocated presidential power, when they advocated the creation of a new kind of presidency. And I've been struck in that work by just how candid and consistent they were about what they were up to. Let me just take a few of the most familiar thinkers, advocates of the presidency, intellectual advocates of the presidency in the 20th century. Henry Jones Ford, the intellectual champion of Woodrow Wilson, described the proper work of the presidency as, quote, the work of the people breaking through the constitutional form. Herbert Croly, the intellectual champion of Theodore Roosevelt, called for a revolt against the monarchy of the Constitution and the overthrow of government by lawyers. Charles Merriam, an intellectual champion of Franklin Roosevelt and a member of the President's Committee on Administrative Management, dismissed constitutional theory as, quote, the rationalization of groups in power or those seeking power. And he proposed to regulate the boundaries of presidential power instead through a more careful mobilization of the collective wisdom of the community at large. And last but not least, most famous perhaps to us, the last of the great progressive tracts, Richard Neustadt's Presidential Power. Neustadt, a member of the Truman administration, and looking forward to the Kennedy administration, presented the problem and the position of the modern presidency as a developmental dilemma. The nation had moved into a world riddled by crises, a world that demanded leadership as routine, but the American Constitution still consigned the president to what he called clerkship. As a practical matter, Neustadt encouraged incumbents to tap all the informal resources at their disposal so as to overcome these conflicts and overcome the divisions of the constitutional frame. In short, a candid, persistent critique of the Constitution and of constitutional reasoning figured prominently in progressive efforts to expand the executive branch, empower the presidency, and create a new presidency-centered government. And I'd like to make a few quick points about this. First, the progressives were not so naive as to think that presidential empowerment alone was the solution. They appealed to extra-constitutional devices to regulate and direct the new concentration of powers that they were championing. They appealed, for example, to science, to professional expertise, to administrative independence, to think tanks, to fact-gathering, to freedom of information, to new forms of journalism, to mobilize public opinion, to interest representation, to pluralist bargaining. These were mechanisms that were to infuse the operations of American government from the outside. They were meant to be brought to bear directly on the presidency and to inform all aspects of governmental operations. They were at once to empower and to control, to energize the presidency by easing interbranch conflicts and fostering interbranch collaboration. They were to facilitate a concert of action out of formal governmental divisions, but do so on democratic and reliable ground. A second point I would make about this is that the progressives were not the first to turn to extra-constitutional mechanisms to solve the riddle of presidential empowerment and political control. So the 20th century relied on an extra-constitutional solution. I would suggest that the 19th century also relied on an extra-constitutional solution. Those who sought to expand the powers of the presidency and control it in new ways in the 19th century invented political parties. The 19th century party solution, like the 20th century progressive solution, looked to instruments organized independent of the formal apparatus of the Constitution, instruments that would surround, infuse, and inform all aspects of interbranch relations. Like the progressives, they sought to energize and to control, to ease interbranch conflicts by creating a new community of interests among the branches, to instigate a concert of action that would be controlled on reliable ground. One party cell in upstate New York put the case in 1862, in the middle of the Civil War, said, Lincoln's responsible for this war, but it's the Republican Party which gives him an army and gives him a navy. It's the Republican Party, not the president, which is the power of this state. The third point I'd like to make about this, and perhaps the most important one, the point that was made earlier this morning, is that the progressive reformers of the 20th century, like the party builders of the 19th century, changed American government profoundly. Indeed, I would suggest that it's because the progressive reform project was so effective for so long, because it succeeded so brilliantly in its aims of loosening the boundaries of government, of rearranging institutional operations and responsibilities, of reorienting our politics, and of empowering the presidency. Because it did all that so effectively, I don't think there's any going back. I'm not suggesting that the challenge to progressive thinking, which pervades our current debates about the presidency, is entirely wrongheaded, just as surely as the progressives had good reason to criticize party-based solutions to the problem of empowerment and control, so we have good reason to challenge the efficacy of their solutions. At the same time, however, I think there's good reason to be skeptical of finding new solutions to the problem of empowerment and control in the Constitution itself. This is, I think, the contemporary dilemma, the dilemma moving forward. The return to constitutional formalism, which we find both in efforts to challenge and restrict the modern presidency and in efforts to defend and expand it, is by historical standards odd. To me, it's an effort to force the genie back into the bottle, and as such, it strikes me as either futile or dangerous. By futile, I would reference those who now renounce the handiwork of the progressives as an imperial presidency and dismiss the 20th century experiment in presidential government as a mistake. Well, maybe it was a mistake, but after decades of elevating the claims of the presidency and rearranging our politics around it, it seems to me a little late to try to leverage the case against current practices with reference to the original constitutional vision. The other way of forcing the genie back into the bottle, however, strikes me not as futile, but downright dangerous. The insistence of the new constitutional conservatives is that these expansive powers and prerogatives of the modern presidency are, on inspection, fully captured and adequately controlled by the Constitution alone. It seems to me that this simply denies what the decades of progressive reform were all about and what their great experiment in presidency-centered government accomplished. Moreover, it seems to me a not so subtle assault on the legitimacy of extra-constitutional controls per se, especially on the controls that the progressives depended upon to control presidential empowerment. It's an assault on the claims of science, administrative independence, fact-gathering, freedom of information. This new constitutionalism upends the progressive project by dismissing the profound recalibration of institutional operations that created modern presidential power and initiative, and it rejects any new forms of control not only as inappropriate, but as illegitimate. Practically speaking, then, I think that we live today in the world created by 20th century reformers. A formal constitutional approach to dealing with the problems they bequeath to us will, I think, at best, leave us spinning our wheels. I think that we need to grapple more directly with the progressive transformation of American government, recognizing that it is a development largely unanticipated by the Constitution and one unlikely to be undone. I would take a cue from the most creative thinkers about American government in the 19th and 20th centuries and suggest that we try to figure out how best to support the presidency in this era of new challenges through a reinvigorated system of extra-constitutional control.
So I wanted to add a couple of very brief comments, sort of inspired by some of the speakers. I'm not sure whether they're going to be very coherent, but maybe they'll at least prompt some discussion. One thing that strikes me is that I'm not quite sure what the presidency is. That is, I know who the president is. That's George W. Bush, right? And we, you know, we all know who he is. We all have seen his picture. What's the presidency? Is the presidency, when we talk about the future of the presidency, do we mean of individual presidents and what they can do? Do we mean the presidency as a kind of public symbol? Do we mean the executive branch as a collective body? I don't think all of those are equivalent. If you look at, for example, relatively recent events, we find that much of what might be considered the imperial presidency could equally well be considered the imperial vice presidency. It's not clear whether, as an individual, the lines of power all and the decision making all stems from one place in the Oval Office. Maybe yes, maybe no. I think we see this with the financial crisis in the last few days. I admittedly haven't followed this in great detail, but as far as I can tell, the president is not significantly involved. The Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Fed and various other actors are the ones who are being deployed to resolve this crisis. When you look at presidential actions, I think we also see that the executive branch, regardless of whether constitutionally it's a unitary body controlled entirely by the president, and despite the efforts by presidents like Clinton and Bush to centralize the executive branch, there still is a good deal of, at least, if not independence, at least resistance that can be exerted within the executive branch. I think, to me, one of the most striking examples was the resistance by military lawyers to aspects of the trial procedures, for example, for Guantanamo and the provisions for detention that ultimately resulted in some modifications even before there was a public outcry. So it seems to me we have a very complicated sort of overlapping set of ideas about what we mean by the presidency. And I'm not sure that they all are going to, if we look forward into the next century, it may not be that they are not all going to march in unison. Another thing that struck me is that there's a bit of tension between the idea of the president as the all-powerful head of the most powerful, strongest hierarchy on earth, and the vision of a world that's increasingly decentralized and networked. Because one would think that in such a world, the most important forms of power would increasingly themselves be decentralized and networked, and that the president's ability to exert authority would depend in part on his ability to act effectively within networks, to recruit partners, and so forth, and perhaps less on the ability to issue unilateral decrees to subordinates, which is, I think, part of our, at least, concept of the president. The president has the power to go to war. He, you know, writes an order, and then that goes to the generals, and that goes to the colonels, and next thing you know, there are privates with boots on the ground somewhere. And then we wonder if that's the right picture, or should there be other things going on. So I do wonder, looking forward into this century, if we think the world is going to change in significant ways in terms of how power is organized and how events are controlled, whether the late 20th century president, for better or worse, will be an effective operator in that world, or whether the presidency may also have to change as the world changes. For example, and not only because of this network thing, but also because the last 50 years of monolithic American power may be breaking down in some ways. We're no longer the largest economy in the world. That's the EU. The Chinese give every indication of making a race for at least second place. Although it's true that we still have enormous influence in a variety of ways, patents and movies and so forth, those are not things that the president controls. One of the things that I have found striking in wearing another hat as an environmental lawyer is both the power of the president to shape environmental policies and the limits of that power, even when you'd think it would be the strongest. I think climate change is a very interesting example, right? The president comes in, he decides he doesn't want to do anything about climate change if it exists at all, and he shuts down international negotiations involving the U.S. He pretty successfully mandates that federal agencies do nothing with this issue and controls the flow of information out of the agencies, and all of that is more or less what you would expect. But then you find that, nonetheless, the United States is moving forward on climate change. Within the next few years, regardless of whether the federal government does anything, the majority of people in the United States will be part of a cap-and-trade system originated by either the northeastern states or California and other western states. even though this is in some ways an area of international concern where you would expect the power of the president perhaps to be at its strongest. And to me, that indicates that in this decentralized world, although the president still remains extremely powerful, as power gets decentralized, the president's ability to influence events may depend on more than just the exercise of legal authority, but rather on the ability to somehow recruit other important players and ensure their cooperation. So I guess the bottom line of this is that if we are moving to a more decentralized networked world, I think that's inevitably going to change the nature of the presidency and the nature of what it means for a president to be effective and powerful. Time will tell what the role of the 21st century presidency will be. And the one thing I'm actually pretty sure of is that everyone on the panel, including me, is wrong, that history will continue to deliver surprises, and that people, when they hold a follow-up conference, maybe in this room in 2025 or 2030, will talk about the naivete of the people at this conference and how all of us failed to foresee the obvious that was staring us right in the face. So I don't know if that's a gloomy note or a cheerful note, I guess. But in any event, I'd like to thank the panelists and also the members of the audience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.